This is an ABC podcast.
Gwen Cherney grew up in the United States. Gwen met Pete, the man who was to become her husband, in Afghanistan. She was working on aid and infrastructure there, and Pete was an Australian security contractor who'd been trained with the Australian Army. Gwen and Pete got married, they had some kids, and with Gwen's support, Pete rejoined the Australian Army. By then, he was in his 40s. But while Pete was deployed in Iraq, he suffered a stroke and he came home to Australia. But things weren't the same between him and Gwen. Pete died in 2017. And Gwen believes that the circumstances of his death meant that she and her family weren't given the same access to support services that they would have if Pete had been killed in the line of duty. Which raises the question, what do we actually mean by the line of duty? Gwen Cherney is a member director of the War Widows Guild, and she's been appointed to the Council for the Australian War Memorial. I spoke to her last year. Hello, Gwen.
Hi.
Tell me about where you grew up in the United States.
I grew up in suburbia, outside of Cleveland, Ohio. It was a small town with a street where you knew everyone, and when your ladder disappeared, you knew that your neighbor had come and gotten it because they had to clean their eaves or something like that. So a very communal place to live and grow up. And when I was 13, I marched downstairs into my kitchen, and my parents were both seated at the kitchen table having their afternoon cup of tea, which was rare, and I declared that I was moving to Florida to ice skate with some coaches that I'd been training with. And that they could either come with me or let me go on my own. And they both did exactly what you're doing. And then 3 months later, I was living in Florida.
Oh, no. All right.
So I've always been a bit strong-willed. And when I have something sort of that I'm searching for or striving for, I usually tend to get there somehow and dragging the people along.
Right, so this is the plan.
Yes.
And you can get on board.
Or get run over by the bus. That's
right,
exactly that's what it is.
So how was it you came to be working in Afghanistan then?
I had done some work in Ecuador, in a small village outside of Quito, and realized that I cared about our global environment and people around the world. For me, it was a real shift in what I wanted to do and how I would sort of go on my journey. So I decided to go to Chile with the Jesuits for 2 years. I did a volunteer program as a social worker in the north of Chile and then came back to the States and again worked with the Jesuits. I helped establish a school for kids from low-income families in a very poor part of Brooklyn, and then a sister school for a boys' school in the Bronx, again, for low-income families in areas where they have very, very low graduation rates. And about 80% of those kids went on to get a four-year degree after they'd gone through the school. And while I was doing that work, I realized that I was really missing that sort of international experience in my life and decided to go back to graduate school, got a master's in public administration with a focus in international policy and development, and had a friend in graduate school who went over to Afghanistan and called me one day and said, come over and help me with this project. And a month later, I paid for a plane ticket and jumped on a plane to Kabul.
So you were already a pretty worldly person by the time you arrived in Kabul. You weren't plucked out of ice skating school or anything like that.
Yes.
You'd actually seen a bit of the world and knew what was involved. So working in aid and development, what did that actually mean on the ground? What kind of work was that for you there?
Well, first it was with the Afghan Women's Network, working with a community of women who were coming together in Kabul and creating support networks for one another. And then I was working with returnee and refugee families doing sort of monitoring and evaluation. So we would go out to villages, stop on the side of the road, knock on doors, and ask if we were right about our services having been delivered to them several years before. And then they'd walk us through the village and we'd go and talk to people and collect information and get back in our old beat up pickup truck and drive back to Kabul. And then I joined a USAID contractor and went over to do local governance community development work, Kandahar, Erzgan, Zabul, so very dangerous, very, very poor and rural areas. And we were working with the military. We were doing women's projects, youth projects, water, building suspension bridges, improving roads. So, I mean, it ran the whole gamut.
As the situation deteriorated, did you have any lucky escapes while you were there?
Well, I was present for two explosions that were close by. I was incredibly lucky because there were houses and compounds that were on our project that were directly targeted, and friends who were killed or injured and are still dealing with the trauma of that.
Tell me about the day you met Pete, the man who was to become your husband.
I believe it was in July. I don't remember the exact date of my arrival in Afghanistan the third time I was there, but he was in very, very short shorts and I had just arrived. I was quite jet lagged.
Short shorts, huh?
Short shorts. I was fully scarved. And
so did you like him because of the short shorts or in spite of the short shorts?
They showed off some fantastic legs.
You will never persuade an Australian man that he's not attractive in short shorts, sadly, unfortunately.
I'll never get used to it either. But he was painting the operations room and had sort of quickly came through, said hello, and then sauntered off. I remember I was definitely taken by the accent, silly girl that I was.
How old was he at that stage?
39.
He was 39. And where were you in your 30s about that point?
I was, I think, 31.
Right. How did things develop between you?
So we were friends. He was actually dated a friend of mine. I flew in and out of Kabul and we chatted. And because he was in charge of a lot of my movements, we interacted quite a bit. But we were very strictly, he was incredibly professional. And then we ended up training in the gym together because we were stuck in a compound and you couldn't just walk around outside and go for a leisurely stroll, if you will. So we saw each other quite a bit. We lived in the same house. So we had dinner together quite frequently with, all of our other housemates. And there was one evening where we were chatting and I reached over and I touched his leg and he just turned to me very abruptly and said, "Please don't ever do that again." And I went, Oh, and then the woman he was dating broke up with him that day, which was interesting. And I was like, "What happened?" And she said, "I'm not getting involved between whatever's going on there. It's lovely. It's very sweet. But I'm out. Enjoy." And I was like, "What do you mean?" And it was a real eye-opener for me because I hadn't realized that I was attracted to Pete.
So what happened when you touched his leg? Was that...
It was like an electric shock.
Right. Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh, goodness." So it was, there was actually a physical attraction there. And I was like, "Okay, definitely need to keep boundaries here." And a few months later, he asked to leave the project and we started dating.
Proof that short shorts work. I'm just saying that, just putting that out there, Gwen. Okay, just putting that out there. Okay. So it wasn't long before Pete returned to Australia while you stayed on in Afghanistan. Was the distance quite painful at that time?
Look, we'd gotten used to distance. So there was a time when I was there and he was in Australia. And then there was a time when he was there and I was in Australia. And I think you get used to that distance. So when it was a part of our lives, when he came back and rejoined the Australian Army, it was something that we were accustomed to. While it's difficult and challenging, I think it also makes you appreciate the time you do have together, but adds pressure.
What kind of military experience had he had by the time you met him?
Pete joined the army when he was 17, left at one stage to take care of a family member, met my stepson's mother, Virginia, and they had a long relationship and he stayed out. He had a decorating and painting business and then rejoined the army, was in Cambodia and Timor, I believe. When he rejoined, he went to 2 Commando, which is a part of the Australian Special Forces, for those who don't know. And he didn't deploy, but was an integral part of setting up our Tactical Assault Group East, which is our military response to terrorism, if you will.
So he had served in Cambodia and in East Timor. And had he seen some degree of combat or violence or in the process of serving in those places?
If I might step back for a second, Pete definitely had trauma from his youth. And that, I think, is important to take into consideration when telling his and our story. So he did have depression and anxiety and struggled. And then he went to Cambodia. I'm not sure about Timor, that there was those events impacted him quite in the same way. But I do know that Cambodia was traumatic for him. And I know that because I would have loved to have traveled to Cambodia with some friends and see the temples and take our children there. And he, every time I mentioned it, he said, if you go, just go get on a plane back to the States because we're finished. I can't do this. I can't worry about you that much. I don't think that he ever experienced something there, like a traumatic event, but I think it was the aftermath that he saw that was incredibly traumatic to him. What had happened to the children, how people maimed one another, how close and intimate that violence was, stayed with him and really caused him pain and suffering. And I don't think that, again, you know, when we talk about his story, that he had post-traumatic stress for those, you know, particular event, but I definitely think that impacted him significantly. And then he spent 5 years as a security contractor. 3 of those years were in Iraq, and 2 of those years were in Afghanistan. I might have that the wrong way around. It might have been 2 in Iraq and 3 in Afghanistan.
I'm with Gwen Cherney. Gwen is an advocate for the War Widows Guild of Australia. She's also an ambassador for the Invictus Games, which are taking place in Sydney in October this year. Her husband, Pete, was an Australian soldier who died last year. Was his mood up and down? Was he prone to depressive spells?
I named Pete our curmudgeon on our project. So definitely up and down, very serious, very, look, he didn't drink. He was the only one on the project that you knew at any given hour, at any time of the day, was sober and on. And that obviously created stress. And when you're constantly on and you're never really able to shut off, I think you have that level of stress that is exhausting. You know, you've got all that cortisol in your blood.
How do you manage it, Gwen, when you're in those highly stressful situations like you were in Afghanistan?
I stopped being able to manage it. So when I went home, you know, I took those breaks. I definitely took months off where we went to Uganda and saw a friend, or I went to Greece and lied on the beach. And that was, you know, a real escape. I had leave in January of 2010, came back to Australia, saw Tom, hung out with Pete, went back to Afghanistan. And day 2, it was as if I hadn't had 23 days off. It was as if I had been there for 6 months and hadn't had a single day off. And I went, this isn't okay. I'm not okay. And then I started losing my temper with staff, not being able to manage stress. It was really quite confronting because that hadn't been quite aggressive behavior, to be frank.
Do you think each of us has I've often wondered about this, a finite amount of courage or resilience under those circumstances that we can give to those situations. We draw from that bank for a while and then the money runs out of that bank. Is that how it is?
I think so. And I think the challenge for our serving men and women is they're at a constant high tempo, especially when they're in the special forces. How do they top up, or how do they empty that bucket if you are using that, you know, the full bucket analogy? How do they empty that while they're still at a high tempo and having to perform so that they have the space to fill it back up with all the stresses? For me, I had to leave. I mean, I had post-traumatic stress. It was never diagnosed, but I'm well and truly aware of what the symptoms are and that it wasn't, again, an event, but it was I couldn't manage the stress levels. Yeah. I was constantly at a high level and then all of a sudden my top would explode over getting the chicken on my way home from work on the bus. And so I ended up leaving Afghanistan in early February of 2010. And it took about a year for me to feel like I could manage that post-traumatic stress.
So both you and Pete decided to give your relationship a chance outside of a war zone, preparing to get married. Tell me about what happened as you were preparing to move to the United States together.
Well, we put our house on the market in Victoria, drove down to Sydney. We were planning a life in the States. We were trying to figure out how he would get a green card or a citizenship and how we would do that transition, what kind of job he would have, or if we would go to the States for a little while and go to Nicaragua or Belize or somewhere in Africa where we could both work together and do similar but different kind of work than we had done in Afghanistan. And we met a really good friend of his for dinner, and he said, oh, you know, tomorrow there's a family day back at the unit, and you guys should come and join us. And Pete was quite excited and said, you know, it'd be lovely to have you meet some of my old mates and show you something I'm so proud of and something that was, you know, really meaningful to me. And so we went, we got on the train at Circular Quay and went out to Holsworthy, and they put on quite a show. It was really quite lovely to get to experience that. Toward the end of the day, I was chatting to a couple of his friends and he was chatting to the commanding officer, and I heard him say, you know, it was that job where I just couldn't wait to get out of bed every morning and go to work. And I turned on my heels and went, then why on earth are we moving to the States? Because I can work anywhere. I mean, I do international development work. I can work in Australia. I can do anything. And he was just like, Piper down. You don't know what you're in for. And I need to give this some thought. And anyway, I've been in the Middle East and he didn't think he could come back. And the commanding officer was like, well, we actually need your skill set. Can I have your phone number and your email? And as he's, you know, sort of writing it down and he's chuckling, going, I'll talk to you soon. And Pete's like, yeah. You wouldn't make a very good military wife. You don't deal well with being told what to do. Got on a plane the next day, moved to the States. He played a little bit of rugby. I was gainfully employed. He was looking around for work and he said, I want to go and do this. Do you think you can? In all honesty, I'm really flexible. I could be happy on a farm in the middle of Victoria. I could be happy in a skyscraping, you know, apartment in New York City. I really don't care. I think it's about life is what you make it. And so for me, I was just like, well, if that's what's going to make you happy, I can be happy doing anything. Let's go.
So when Pete re-enlisted in the army, was it a case of him picking up where he left off?
No. He left as a sergeant and came back as a corporal, which for him was moment of discernment, if you will. Because he had been out for 5 years.
Right. So he's a 40-year-old corporal. That must have been hard for him.
Mm. Well, especially someone who'd been program manager in a massive project in USAID in Afghanistan.
And working with Special Forces, as you said, as well.
Yeah. So then coming back as a corporal into the Special Forces was a hit to his ego. And also, you're underutilizing my skills. It's not like I've been off sculpting or painting or doing something that's completely in total banking, even if you will, completely irrelevant in his mind to what he was doing. He was going, all of the things that I gained over there were relevant. We're still in Afghanistan. I know Kabul like the back of my hand. Why aren't you using me? But I think, you know, I don't like to criticize defense because I think it's important and they have their policies and procedures for a reason. But for someone like him to come in and have to then take orders and not have any authority or ability to act independently, and because, you know, that's the corporal position is to do. They're the doers.
Was it a bit like you've lost your place in the queue, now go back to the back of the queue?
Yeah, it was very painful. And having come back to a unit that had done rotation after rotation after rotation of tours in Afghanistan and quite, you know, active ones where they were involved in conflict the entire time they were there, you also had very young diggers who didn't have respect for someone who'd been gone and came back in. And they were going, now you have to pay your dues again.
So he'd said you wouldn't make much of an army wife. He was being deployed and redeployed to Afghanistan. How did you go as an army wife?
Well, I sort of ignored the fact that that was the case my first year. Which was incredibly painful. My first year here in Australia, I was very disconnected to the defence community. I'd had two defence wives approach me, and I sort of rejected those friendships. A bad rap. Didn't want to get involved in that. Wanted a life outside of the army. Wanted Pete to have that space to not have to work all the time and be connected only to those who he was working with. But when he went to Afghanistan in 2012, I was pregnant with my daughter and she was born while he was away. And I realized in that moment, I really needed that defense network support. And there was an enormous amount of support from a group of women who were army wives, if you will, who came and, you know, showed up at the hospital, made sure that I had technology to talk to Pete, and they weren't sure if I was there at the hospital on my own. So they sort of, when they found out I was in labor, they actually showed up just to make sure I was okay and had support. And then, well, the entire time that he was away, they were at my house dropping off cakes and checking in on me.
And were you wondering, why did I deprive myself of this support network?
Well, my work and my career were my focus my first year as well, and it was mostly in Canberra, so my entire network was in Canberra. So I was like, I just felt blessed, really, to have this amazing support of women around me, and I went, this is something that needs to be encouraged, not discouraged.
And how long was it before you got to actually meet your baby daughter?
Well, a very good friend of ours was injured in Afghanistan 4 weeks after 3 weeks after Emily was born, and he brought him home. So he got to meet Emily when she was 4 weeks old.
Did he make it for the birth of your next baby?
Barely.
Barely? But he did get there.
He did get there in the end.
How was the timeline on that?
He was involved in something in the city. My son was born on the 16th of December 2014. Again, I said that he was a part of Tactical Assault Group East, and they were prepared to respond to a terrorist activity.
This is the Martin Place hostage situation.
Yes, so they were prepared to respond to that.
So he was standing by for that while you're giving birth?
While I was giving birth, yes.
Oh, man.
And there was, you know, we had a conversation that night, and I said, if you don't come home, you might as well get on a plane and go to Iraq, because you're more likely to live fighting ISIS than you are if you miss the birth of your next child. And I wasn't kidding. And he said, I'm not leaving. I'm staying here. This is what I've trained for, and you're fine. And I think part of our story is that Pete always knew I was fine. Pete trusted that I was that rock that could deal with anything, which was a struggle sometimes, because he was, you know, you don't need me, that, you know, you're fine without me. And I was like, no, trust me, I need you here. But that, you know, understanding that if he couldn't be there, I'd had to do whatever I needed to do to be okay. He did in the end make it, and it was the same day as his son Tom was born. So both of my boys share the same birthday.
How was it to find a rhythm for you guys as a family with him being taken away and being deployed, coming back and forth from places like Afghanistan on a regular basis?
Look, I think you end up acting as if you're a single mom when they're that busy, with a very loving partner at the end of the day. You know, you get a quick check-in, a 3 or 4 minute, sometimes half an hour at maximum. Hey, how you going? What do you need? Or next morning, hey, have a good day, love you. And you get used to being really independent. I think for Pete, he struggled.
What was he like between deployments once he got home?
Look, it varied. It was very up and down. He was very engaged, very loving, very funny and endearing and charismatic.
All the reasons you married him.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he was very distant and quiet and cranky, and a real exhaustion with just, you know, even when they're just training, they're on. They're worried about their safety officers. They're worried about someone dying when they're doing drills and shooting and explosives. And so every single day that they go to work, they're acutely aware that someone's life depends on whether or not they're paying attention and doing their job right. And that's an enormous amount of stress and an enormous amount of pressure. Pete, especially, you know, other people can manage that stress better than he did. But for him, he was just constantly on. And the turning off just meant he wanted a quiet, calm, silent household. And you can't get that with a 2-year-old.
No, you can't. No. When he was down, how down was he? Was he dipping down into major depressive episodes at this point?
Absolutely. It was, you know, it was as if we were on a roller coaster that just went up and down and up and down. And there was, you know, you're not supportive. No one loves me. There's no reason I should be here. I'm leaving you, to very happy, fun, dancing in the kitchen with the kids. And it wasn't bipolar, but it was this constant up and down, and you weren't sure what you were going to get in every day. Again, I just lived like a single mom who didn't really need very much.
Well, he's a guy in his 40s at this point. He would have had some awareness of his mood situation? Did he seek help? Did you ask him to get help for these severe mood swings?
To say he had an awareness is not giving him enough credit. He knew that he struggled, and he was one of the mental health first aid trainers in his unit. So he was educated in mental health and well-being. He knew all the signs and symptoms.
But what about for himself? Did he seek help for himself?
Now, apparently, unbeknownst to me, in November of 2016, he did do a phone call or sought assistance for his anxiety around his work. And for me, that would have been a red flag going, yay, you're finally going to, you know, you're using this as your excuse to talk to them. And then all of this other stuff will come through. So he, I believe, did an intake phone call, but didn't show up to the appointment, which was, you know, obviously could have been life-changing for him.
Why do you think he...
Fear. He knew. In 2009, he was suicidal when I was in Afghanistan, and he was here. And he went and got support in Wangaratta. And a couple of things came out. One was that his identity was wrapped up in his career, and then he identified as a security officer, a soldier, a carer, protector. And when he didn't have that role, he didn't know how to be just him. He was meaningless. For someone who is incredibly, incredibly successful in his career, it's really painful to me to know how insecurity just tore at his soul every day.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Gwen, before you were talking about the therapy that Pete had. What was it that he realised about himself, his situation, that he found so devastating?
In that therapy, when he was there, he realised that he couldn't help, he couldn't protect me, he couldn't save me if something happened. Now I was running around Erzgan with the US ambassador at one point, and he knew that no one's eyes would be on me. And he knew how dangerous that was. And there was an enormous amount of fear there. And that was self-criticism. And realized in that time period that it was a lot of work, and it was very painful to talk about where he was and his emotions and all of those things. So I think for Pete, he knew what the journey would be, and it was really big because it wasn't just Cambodia. It wasn't just childhood. Like it wasn't just his mom. There was a lot of trauma that he would have to go back and revisit to heal.
Are you also saying that it would have meant picking apart his very self-conception, his very idea of himself as a protector? Was that involved in it too?
Absolutely.
That's not so easily undone, that. That's rooted in his fundamental sense of self then.
Absolutely. And to ask a 48-year-old man to tear apart your sense of self is challenging. It's doable. It's possible that, you know, if you look around you, you have normally, if you actually look, you have love and support that will help you get through that and do that. And it is something that we have to do in our lives, you know, challenge that sense of self, but it's terrifying.
So in 2016, Pitt went to Iraq, and while he was there, he suffered a stroke. He's in his mid-40s, mid to late 40s at this point. How did they know it was a stroke? How did that present itself suddenly?
He was working, and he was standing in the in his office and felt what he described as vertigo, and told a number of people around him that they had to get him to the hospital immediately. The attending doctor spoke to him, was on the phone. She was a U.S. doctor, And she spoke to a university, from what I understand, in the U.S., who was sort of on call because they had limited resources. They didn't have MRI machines. They didn't have all the facilities you would have in a normal hospital. And so I believe they had them on call to consult. And during the consulting phase, they determined that he had had a stroke, and they would give him an injection. And the injection, he could choose to have it or not. The injection, if it was a clot, would clear the clot and improve recovery. If it was bleed out, then he could potentially die. He handed his phone and my phone number to the attending doctor and said, give me the injection and call my wife immediately and tell her. Went completely outside of the defense chain of command and protocols, because we'd had an argument once when we were in Afghanistan where he went off to do a recovery effort and told me he was going into a meeting. And I said that if I was going to be on board in this relationship, I wanted to know where he was so that I had the proper level of worry and preparedness in myself to know what would come at me if something happened to him. So I didn't want to think that he was in a meeting and then hear that he'd been shot dead in the middle of Afghanistan.
You couldn't possibly have been prepared for this then?
I knew he wasn't okay. He had worked 189 days straight. And I had told a mutual friend of ours who was traveling and was actually going to see him that day, but didn't get there before the stroke, that Pete was tired, exhausted, and that if something wasn't done to get him some rest, this wasn't going to end well for him or anyone else. Those were my words. And then that next day he has a stroke and there's no ability to, you know, respond. And that was my way of giving the chain of command a heads up that my husband wasn't okay.
So in taking the injection, he was rolling the dice then, because the stroke couldn't be diagnosed properly.
Right.
It could have helped heal him enormously or kill him.
Absolutely.
So what happened once he took the injection?
You couldn't tell that he'd had a stroke when he came home. There was a slight visual impairment in his upper left quadrant, but it was very minor. And for all intents and purposes, no one could tell that he'd had a stroke, but his cognitive abilities were still not quite right. And to be in a really high-performing environment and know that your brain hasn't healed and you're not performing at your normal levels, it's scary.
Did that lead to a kind of shortness of temper in him?
Yes, as well a lot of irritability. So, you know, if you're working on your computer and your child interrupts or yells or something, you might snap, or you might, you know, say, could you quiet down? And if they've been doing it for half an hour, your level of stress or response might be higher than that. And his was an immediate, just high-level response to our kids, which was rare. So he would be impatient or angry with me or our eldest son, but with the two little ones, he was incredibly patient, incredibly loving. He would even get frustrated at me about going, they're too much for me. Can you remove them from the house and go to the park? Whereas it was directed at to them. And I very quickly knew that he wasn't okay with them.
With that irritability, were you ever scared of him?
Absolutely. Which is interesting, because my husband would never have thought that I was scared of him. I think I probably intimidated him more than he thought he was capable of intimidating me. I just don't think he had a real sense of understanding of his size, his strength, or his power, which I think is probably true for quite a few domestic violence perpetrators, if you will. I don't think that he knew how scary he was when he was out of control. And I had an enormous amount of fear around that. We'd discussed it. We'd actually gone to therapy, and we actually had together a couple of times, and then decided he wouldn't continue, which was incredibly frustrating to me. And we had a plan. And it was, you know, if I see you escalating, it doesn't matter what state I'm in, I remove myself and the kids, I have a bag by the door at all times and keys by the door at all times, and we go. And we come back whenever we think things have calmed down, to just remove ourselves from the situation, because I don't mind conflict. But when I engage and you're getting a response that can become violent, it was important for us to have those strategies in place. And I managed it. You know, I constantly walked on eggshells. I constantly tried to figure out how I could approach him to make sure that I didn't trigger something. So it was incredibly exhausting to manage that.
When he was violent, was he ashamed afterwards?
There was a lot of blame put on me. And then it was,
It's your fault. You made me like this.
You made me like this. And I don't want to be that person. And then there was an enormous amount of self-loathing that happened in there. But what was verbalized was, it's all your fault. If you'd just be loving, if you'd just be patient with me, if you'd just support me, I wouldn't do these things. And I was like, right, well, you need to take responsibility. And then it would escalate again. So I had to be, it's complicated.
Well, there are moments when you thought, you know, I was once this aid worker traveling all over the world, and now here I am in this house with this man that I'm frightened of. Did you just want to get away?
I think I realized a long time ago that Pete was, I realized or accepted or decided, I think, that Pete was my burden to bear. And instead of being out naively saving the world, if you will, and assisting other communities in that growth and development, I think I wanted to save Pete. Sadly, I think that was part of my sense of self. And it was very wrapped up in that. And I'd already, I wanted him to be okay. I wanted him to be with his children. I wanted him to be a part of our family. And so while I could have easily said, I'm done, I'm out, I didn't want to leave him. I loved him deeply. And felt, you know, I do feel like marriage is a contract. And I feel like, you know, if you can do something to make it work, that you should. And that's, there are extreme cases, and many people will think that mine is one of those. But I didn't want to leave. I just wanted him to get help. And I believe I'm a hopeful human. And I hoped that eventually he would see that he could get help and would be okay.
What happened to bring matters to a head?
He yelled at one of our kids when he was trying to write his bio. It was a task for a promotion course that the Army had put him on. And he was feeling really stressed after the stroke about whether the Army wanted to keep him or were trying to show him the door. And there was very little trust that he put in anything that they were doing to try and show him that he was still a valued, integral part of that unit. And so he's preparing to go on this course. His cognition isn't really working. And he's really struggling with basic, you know, writing, basic processing, and then having, rowdy little kids just sort of set him off. And an impatient wife who's sort of going, get some perspective, mate. Like, you're healing. No one expects you to perform at the level that you were before. We've got kids, like, pull your head in. It's all going to be okay. It was, you know, 6 months after the stroke, I was getting, I think, probably impatient with him not being able to manage that stress. And we just got into an absolute ripper of an argument. And I realized all of these things that he was saying to me, he was feeling about himself. And when it calmed down, he was having a cup of coffee outside, and I opened the door and I said, look, I love you. And if you really want a divorce, I'll give you one. I don't believe you. But, you know, if you're saying all of these things about me, it's really painful to know that you feel them about yourself, because none of them are true about me. None of them are true about you. But if you're saying them, you're feeling this really low self-esteem and low sense of self right now. And he finished his cup of coffee, came inside, said something. I said something back, probably, I don't recall what it was, and he came at me. It was like the lights went off in his eyes, and it was terrifying. And he stepped on one of my, I think it was Lockie, and tossed Emily out of the way. And I went to grab my keys and get out of the house, and I got hit and ran to my neighbor's house. And in that moment, I realized, because my children were terrified and they'd seen it, and the ages that they were, I could no longer protect them from it or hide any of that from them, that he needed help before we were able to come back and engage. So I left on a Friday. He played golf on Saturday, went to Bunnings that night, and then suicided on Monday morning.
And he talked about taking his own life?
He did. And he actually, I woke up Monday morning to a slew of missed calls and text messages basically saying goodbye. I found out that he told our son goodbye on that Sunday night via text message, but wouldn't answer his phone call. There was a message that said, "How long would it take you to get here?" And as much as I would have liked to have responded to that, as much as I would have liked to have just jumped in the car, I knew that we would go back into the same cycle. Mm-hmm. I knew that he wouldn't get help. I knew that I would be to blame and that nothing would change and he wouldn't be okay. And as in 2009, when I said, "Go get help," and I cannot be your sole support here, I really hoped, and I even wrote to him, you got help once for your kids, for me. I want you to go and get help for your kids now. And an hour later, he was gone.
What were the weeks and months after his death like for you?
Blurry. Cold.
What was the Department of Defense able to do to help? Were they able to help? Could they have done things differently with you?
The Department of Defense, his unit specifically, were incredibly supportive. There were friends, members of the unit who spent, the week with us, just sitting next to us, making sure the stacks of paperwork were done and all the everything, every support, every benefit that we could receive was accessed, was organized. We had reached out to who we needed to reach out to, and just, were there in solidarity with us, really.
What about in the period leading up to his death?
No. In the period leading up to his death, and this is the thing that I have worked with and talked to defense about quite extensively, is that between the moment he touched down from Iraq in Australia with his stroke until the Friday before he died, I had no contact with the unit. They didn't proactively reach out to me. They didn't, they worked directly with Pete on his recovery. There was no recognition that there's a carer and a family attached to him who need to understand what that rehabilitation process looks like, what the likelihood of transitioning out of the army might be, and what possibilities, if he is to stay in, what the timelines are, what that looks like, not because you want to breach their privacy, but because you want to understand and be able to assist in the rehabilitation process. And then know when the doctor's appointments are and what my responsibilities as a carer to make sure he's okay and has what he needs, and I can take that time off work and be present, and can also provide that perspective when, I know when my mom was diagnosed with cancer, the first thing the doctor said was, "Do not come to my office alone. Bring someone with you, because you will hear the first thing I say, your mind will go reeling, you won't hear anything else I say, and you need someone to help you process the information and remember things that you won't be able to remember, because you'll be so concerned with what's going on with your health and well-being." And that's exactly what happened with Pete. He would go into these meetings, these welfare boards, with his commanding officer and the leadership. They'd tell him one thing and he'd come home with something completely different. But because I wasn't present, I wasn't invited, I wasn't even informed that these meetings were going on until afterward, I couldn't assist. I couldn't provide that extra information. I couldn't provide that informed sounding board for him.
You joined the War Widows Guild. How has that helped you over the past year?
When I was introduced to the War Widows Guild, it was like these women were wrapping their arms around me with love and support. They understood. They understood the pain, the suffering, the trauma, and the relief of not having to live through that daily nightmare and the worrying and the caring and all of those things that you have to do when they're alive. For many of those women, they lose their partners many years before they actually die because they're for many reasons. So I found a home, if you will. I found a nonna and probably a surrogate grandmother for my children. and, you know, companionship, friendship, support, a place to know I'm not alone, a place to confide in, and a place to complain when I'm frustrating and when I feel like my own community doesn't necessarily understand.
What do you think about the circumstances of Pete's death? He was suffering psychological wounds, maybe from his service, maybe from his childhood, maybe from this or from whatever reason. How do you think the defence forces view the, if you like, psychological injuries he might have suffered in the line of duty? Do they see that as a kind of a war wound, and should they?
This is something I'm really grappling with right now. As I was at the War Memorial and got a tour by Brendan Nelson, and when you walk down the Roll of Honour, and you know that those stories are, you know, complicated. They aren't just clear-cut, died in service, you know, and many of them are, and many of them are not. You know, when you see that the training names, the deaths through training, aren't up on the wall, you go, well, how is that different? So they died in New Zealand through a crack in snow. How is that different than someone who died in an explosion in Iraq? Why is one given more honor and acknowledgement than the other? And then if there is a difference, and that these men and women who serve, you know, really need to determine that, but it's not just about them and their opinions, because their families are here, are the ones who are at home, keeping the fabric of our Australian society together while they're gone, and picking up those pieces when they come back. So isn't that role of honour in many ways also for those left behind, as much as it is for those mates who've served and are left behind, and for those who actually died in service? So I think for me, I'm really grappling with how do we acknowledge the mental war wounds? Because if Pete had died or killed himself in Iraq when he was there, his name would be on the Roll of Honour. But because he did it in our garage, how on earth is that different? Why do we not honour him the same way? Why do we not look at his service in the same way? And that's where that acknowledgement is. And even if it's not on the Roll of Honour and there's another way that we do it, I think it's important to. I think it's not just important to acknowledge their service for the sake of acknowledging their service, but for honouring the family and what they've sacrificed and that they're left behind, and teaching our children and our community what war does to our men and women who we ask to serve this country. And that piece is the most compelling to me.
Having taken on an advocacy role now with the War Widows Guild, what change do you want to see?
That's a big question. Where would you like me to start? And how many hours do we have?
9. The other shows won't mind if I crash into them, I'm sure.
I'm working with Department of Veterans Affairs and Defense on a couple of initiatives, which are really all about the acknowledgement of the family as that amplifier, that support system, that we are better together. And by that recognition and acknowledgement of the family's role, the sacrifices they make and the support that they provide so that our serving men and women can go and do what they do, be it 6 weeks of training in Australia in Pakapanyal while they're posted in Brisbane, or be it, you know, 6 to 8 months at a time in Iraq or Afghanistan, or to who knows where our government might send them, that they get that acknowledgement so that they can get the services they need and the support they need, so we are not traumatizing our next generation.
You're an ambassador also for the Invictus Games, which are going to take place later this year. What's your role with them? What do you want to be understood about that, and how that connects to your husband's service?
I've been asked by Clubs New South Wales to be an ambassador for the Invictus Games 2018 in Sydney from the 20th to the 27th of October. It's pretty exciting. I think the really amazing part about the Invictus Games is that they acknowledge and include the families. They recognize that you know, the serving men and women who are wounded, injured, or ill are in need of that family support system, are in need of their carers, and they recognize that, acknowledge it, and honor it. And the Invictus Games is not just about the medals, it's not just about the sport, which is amazing and really just tremendous to watch what you think would be humanly impossible actually be possible, but that they include that family and that wider community in that. So it's not just that you're standing there in a stadium watching a sport, but they've found a way to include the families. They've found a way to honor all that behind-the-scenes stuff that these families do to make sure that these men and women are okay every day.
It's been amazing speaking with you. Thank you so much, Gwen.
Thanks for having me.
On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. Find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
I spoke with Gwen Cherney last year, ahead of the Invictus Games that were held in Sydney. Gwen continues her advocacy work for war widows and families. And if hearing Gwen's story has raised any issues for you, Lifeline is there for you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. 13 11 14. That's 13 11 14. Today's conversation with Gwen will be available as a podcast on our website soon, abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.